This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED. We're focusing on toxic shock syndrome today. This is an acute, toxin-mediated sickness with fever, hypotension, multi-organ dysfunction, and skin changes. It's treatable if it's diagnosed early, but if it's missed, it's rapidly lethal. Let's start with a little bit of pathophysiology. Some streptococcal and some staphylococcal species secrete superantigens. These cause widespread activation of T lymphocytes, which results in a cascade of inflammatory cytokines leading to multi-organ failure. There are two predominant forms. There's a streptococcal form and a staphylococcal form. The streptococcal form is much more common and affects patients of all ages. Toxic shock is more common than we initially thought. It affects about 20% of patients with an invasive group A streptococcal infection. Group A strep is by far the most commonly associated microbe with toxic shock syndrome, but group B strep may also cause it. Over the last couple decades, the prevalence of the streptococcal form has increased, mainly due to changes in the circulating strains of group A strep. You need to think about toxic shock syndrome in any patient with an invasive streptococcal infection. The most common focus of infection is a soft tissue infection like cellulitis, myositis, pharyngitis, a surgical wound infection, or even necrotizing fasciitis. However, you need to keep toxic shock syndrome in mind as it can be a result from any invasive infection, including pneumonia, peritonitis, and even gynecologic infections. Staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome is much less common and it affects mainly younger patients, those less than age 40, because most patients by the time they reach adulthood have antibodies to staphylococcal toxins. Staphylococcal toxic shock may result from methicillin-sensitive Staphylococcus aureus or MRSA. This typically results from colonization without invasive infection. There's menstrual-related forms, which occur in about 50%, and then non-menstrual forms, which can be due to burn infections, a post-surgical infection, a postpartum wound infection, and also pneumonia. There are two primary components of how these patients present. There's the primary site of infection and the systemic effects from toxin production. In some cases, the clinical presentation is really dominated by toxin secretion, whereas in some other cases, the primary focus of infection is going to be much more obvious on your exam. For the primary focus of infection, in the staphylococcal form, this is often not visible or clinically silent. The staphylococcal toxin suppresses neutrophil function, which decreases local signs and symptoms of that infection. In streptococcal toxic shock syndrome, most patients will have an evident focus of infection, like that cellulitis, pneumonia, or even that necrotizing fasciitis that we talked about. In some cases, that primary focus can be really subtle, including a small skin abscess or even a small area of cellulitis. A red flag that should make you think about toxic shock is that patient who presents with a relatively unimpressive focus of infection, but they have septic shock. Most patients won't develop shock due to just cellulitis alone. For toxin production, many of these patients will present with a flu-like syndrome, fever, chills, headache, myalgias, and sore throat, something we see on a very routine basis. Vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal pain are also very common, so you need to think about toxic shock syndrome in that patient who presents with flu-like illness or GI symptoms and they're hypotensive. Skin findings are present in about 10% of patients. A diffuse erythematous rash is most characteristic. This might be subtle and resemble a sunburn. It's typically blanchable and can also involve the palms and soles. Erythema may even involve the mucous membranes, including the conjunctiva, and give you that strawberry tongue appearance. A diffuse maculopapular rash can occur, which can be pruritic. Keep in mind that desquamation is typically a delayed finding and will be absent in the initial stages of the disease. Patients will also present with multisystem organ failure. Hypotension, tachycardia, and systolic heart failure are very common. Acute renal failure is also common and often disproportionately severe compared to other changes in their hemodynamics. Finally, delirium can be present due to encephalopathy. Your labs may reveal an elevated white blood cell count and a significantly elevated neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. However, not all patients will have an elevated white blood cell count. You might find anemia and thrombocytopenia. Thrombocytopenia is characteristic, but this is often present in later stages of the disease. your coagulation panel may reveal full-blown disseminated intravascular coagulation. AKI is often the first sign of organ injury with an elevated creatinine and BUN. This frequently occurs at an earlier stage than in other cases of septic shock, and it usually precedes hypotension. Creatinine kinase is often elevated, as well as bilirubin, AST, and ALT. In fact, elevated liver function tests are components of the diagnostic criteria. However, mild changes in the liver function tests are commonly seen in other septic patients, which means they're nonspecific. What about your blood cultures here? Unfortunately, blood cultures are negative in over 95% of cases of toxic shock syndrome due to the staphylococcal form. You'll want to obtain swabs of mucosal surfaces or wounds, but again, these are nonspecific. In the streptococcal form, blood cultures have a yield of about 60%. If there's a local site of infection, you'll want to obtain cultures of that site. Now, obviously, with this history, exam, and the lab findings, you have a very wide differential. You need to think about meningitis, spinal epidural abscess, infective endocarditis, tick-borne illnesses like Rocky Mountain spotted fever, adrenal crisis, scarlet fever, myocarditis, and shock due to other causes. There are some red flags that can help you with the diagnosis. The first one are those skin findings that we talked about. Second, if you have a patient with suspected or known streptococcal infection who presents with septic shock. The next one is a soft tissue infection plus septic shock. Most patients with cellulitis don't have septic shock. This is unusual and suggests toxic shock syndrome. The next one is that patient who presents with gastroenteritis or a flu-like illness plus hemodynamic instability or a dramatic left shift with an elevated neutrophil lymphocyte ratio. Really, the key takeaway is to consider the diagnosis early and often and think about those red flags that we talked about. Also evaluate for those alternative diagnoses. If toxic shock syndrome is on the table, then begin treatment. If you're wrong and the patient doesn't end up having toxic shock syndrome, you're still doing a great job caring for that patient. Now, up to this point, we haven't talked about the CDC diagnostic criteria, and there's a reason for that. These were designed for research studies, not for everyday clinical use. Achieving a good outcome in these patients depends on us starting our therapy before the full-blown syndrome develops. Also, keep in mind that the sensitivity and specificity of these criteria have not been validated in other settings. I'll include a table in the show notes depicting these different criteria, but they basically take into account clinical and lab findings. Without further ado, let's get to our management and resuscitation. You'll want to start with IV fluids. However, many of these patients have leaky capillaries and won't respond well to fluids, so have a low threshold to begin vasopressors. Early use of stress-steroids can also help because these patients often develop refractory shock and they have underlying immune dysregulation. There are several important considerations when it comes to the antibiotic. Your backbone is going to be some form of a beta-lactam antibiotic. These have uniform effectiveness against streptococcal species and they have low toxicity. In that undifferentiated patient, a good choice is piperacillin tazobactam or meropenem. Another important consideration is to provide something with toxin suppression. This can include clindamycin and or linezolid. Clindamycin is the most widely recommended. This has activity against nearly all streptococcal species and most staphylococcal species. It does do a good job covering group A streptococcal infections that are severe. However, clindamycin resistance is increasing, so this is why you need to combine it with a beta-lactam. Linezolid has the advantages of suppressing toxin secretion and covering all streptococcal and staphylococcal species, including MRSA. There is some evidence suggesting that the combination of linezolid plus clindamycin is superior to either agent alone. The other important component of your treatment of sepsis is source control. Any focus of infection which is potentially secreting a toxin must be aggressively drained or debrided. This can be very challenging, however, because that area of infection may not be impressive. Thus, you need to have a low threshold to obtain definitive imaging to look for that source of infection. Because of the toxin production, surgical wounds should be considered infected even if they appear benign. If you have that patient with necrotizing fasciitis, the best place for that patient is the OR. The final component of therapy is IVIG, which really functions as an adjunctive medication. This may inhibit T-cell activation by blocking or inactivating those superantigens, which results in decreased cytokine release. This medication can reduce severe immune response and while the data are limited, the medication is probably safe. This medication is expensive, so it's best left to your intensivist. And that brings me to disposition. These patients will need admission to an ICU setting. Let's provide some take-homes here. Toxic shock syndrome is a potentially lethal, toxin-mediated illness that can mimic many other diseases. Staphylococcus aureus and Streptococcus pyogenes are by far the most common microbes associated with the disease, which is due to superantigens that trigger a massive immune response. Disease results from this toxin production and the local site of infection. Symptoms are nonspecific and can include fever, chills, rash, GI symptoms, and hypotension. The staphylococcal form is more commonly associated with symptoms from toxin production, while the streptococcal form is most commonly linked to the site of infection. Labs may show anemia, thrombocytopenia, elevated liver enzymes, renal injury, elevated lactate, and abnormal coagulation studies. Diagnostic criteria from the CDC are available to help with the diagnosis, but they miss early cases of the disease and should not be relied upon. Management includes IV fluids, vasopressors, source control, and antibiotics. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.